Talk to you. So here we are, not exactly together, not precisely and completely apart, in a world in which what holds us together is words. Words in a journal, words on a pad, words in a wiki, words on tape recording. Words that make things happen in a society that consists of us. The most important thing that happens, at least I hope, is learning. But in the conversations I'm having with you, using words this way, that way, I am aware that learning is itself a word. Complex and difficult as words are. Holmes says in a letter to Sir Frederick Pollock, ideas are not often hard, but words are the devil. Or at any rate, a complexity. Learning is a word with apparently many meanings. It seems that law school has begun to achieve its most importantly destructive unintended effect. Learning has come to mean something like saying yes or no to stuff and getting it right on the exam. And while, of course, words can mean anything in that sense, that's not what I think learning means. Nor do I think that learning is what can be measured by examination. The question of how to evaluate learning may be even more complicated than learning, because evaluation is another tricky word. But let us say at any rate that the purposes that I think we're serving together aren't purposes which are met when your thinking is approaching something called a model answer or model thinking. And creativity and model thinking, I don't even think they're quite like oil and water. I don't think you can shake them up in a flask with a little egg white and hope that it'll stay together for a while. I believe they move in opposite directions, like matter and antimatter. At any rate, what learning means, from my point of view, in a process of education, that is to say, getting something out, the something not being a Socratic proof of an idea that it could be held even in the minor, barely animal mind of a slave boy and can be brought out by careful questioning. That would be something more like cross-examination, a hostile activity. Education, that is, getting something out that is in there, is about your being more yourself, getting more out of what it means to be you, to which a model, well, it could be an inspiration, but it could hardly be, in any meaning of the word, an execution. The most important way in which we deal with the conflict between the ideas that are easy and the words that are hard is on the page, in reading. Reading is an act of commitment, not an act of betrayal. Law school has a tendency to make it appear, as I have mentioned, that the primary question when reading a thing is it right or wrong, where right or wrong means the outcome of some argument you can start. This is not a particularly good way to go to school, not even law school. It undermines itself. But the alternative is much more risky. We have to commit ourselves to what we read. In the same way that when we are listening to music, we have to be committed to the music that we're listening to. But that's easier because artistry is about getting the commitment. Whether that turns out to be a positive feeling or a negative feeling doesn't matter. It's commitment. And in anything to which we are committed, there are moments of doubt and anger and sense of discomfort, as there are moments of peace and pleasure and hope. To be committed in reading is to read with heart. To be engaged not merely in translating words into notes or taking a half recollection of something and putting it away for the exam, but rather to be feeling sequence and rhythm and counterpoint in precisely the way that one listens in a committed form to music. And there is harmony. Harmony is not the same thing as consonance. It used to be, when there was Stravinsky, that in his late life Hollywood form, at parties sometimes, people would complain to him that his music, they meant the later 12-tone music, was dissonant. To which he had an answer. He would walk over to the piano where the piano was, wherever it was, and he would strike a chord full of apparent non-consonant harmony and let that sit a moment and ask, so is that dissonant? And everybody would say yes. And then he would begin to play the Bach organ piece from which whatever chord it was that he had taken was first generated. Because, of course, the question whether it was dissonant or not depended upon where it was. And that's the thing about committed reading. You have to be concerned always about where you and the text both are. Quibbling will not do it. As you see from watching your own and others' writings on the pad, law school has done its work. It has not only made you capable of law talk conversationally, which was the intended purpose of the first term through which you just passed, it has also enabled you to quibble beautifully, compulsively, like the act of boring the partner or the date in line at the restaurant. The quibbling is a sign of the obsessive success of the program. But like briefing cases, it's a structure that was meant to raise another building on, and it's time for the scaffold to come apart. You don't need to be a quibbler now. You need to be a committed reader. To read committedly, to read carefully, to read with the engagement of all you have, is to treat the text as a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional object, like a parts explosion or a blueprint. or a terrain map. The text contains a three-dimensional structure relating ideas and their possibilities to one another in time through sequence, counterpoint, and rhythm. The Path of the Law is not just a talk given at the dedication of a law school library by a judge. That's true. A one-dimensional representation of a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional section of a powerful mind. The goal in reading carefully is to have all the working parts of that three-dimensional structure clear in your mind to understand how they relate to one another. And, like a Rubik's Cube, to be capable of turning them in your mind so as to make them different, yet the same. To know a piece is to know it in that way, as to have learned a piece of music is to have it in your mind, in your feelings, and in your hands all at once in three different dimensional ways. So what is, in that sense, the path of the law? The path on which Holmes is setting the reader out is the path that was followed by the law thought of the 20th century in America. Its distinctiveness, the thing we call legal realism, begins more or less here. Not more or less in this talk, but more or less in this set of ideas, in this mind, like the other minds around it. That of, let us say, Chauncey Wright and John Dewey and William James and Charles Peirce. But it isn't for the moment our need to pass the sociology of this idea across the three dimensions of the idea. We'll begin that next week. Nor is it primarily our task as intellectual historians to understand what these ideas came from and where these ideas are going to. We will live a little bit of that out over the next several weeks. Now it is merely our attempt to understand in three dimensions those parts which move this thought along. And let us begin there with one of the two fundamental tenets of legal realism in America, which has no clearer expression than this path of the law, that things are what they do, not what they're called. That the understanding of what law is depends upon what lawyers, courts, and judges do, what agencies of government achieve, what the function is of the squad car, the sheriff's vehicle, the meeting at the White House to decide whether to fire the acting attorney general so that another thug can do the work of undermining the election more capaciously. What things do, not what they're called, is what, for the legal realist, they are. Hence Holmes' fundamental point, which is that the limitations of the law lie in the relationship of what it does to the way in which we talk about it. The ideas are not hard. The words are the devil. Hence the point that if you want to know what law is, if you want to know the law and nothing else, if you want to analyze it, pull it out and see it for what it is, like the dragon whose claws are under inspection, then the language one should use about it is language related to what it does, not even what it hopes to do. let alone what others might hope it is. The language of morality is problematic, Holmes says, because it confuses us about the boundaries of the subject. The bad man has, over the decades that I have lived with him and Holmes and law students, caused a lot of confusion. It isn't necessarily the best way to put the point, unless what you want is to divide the quibblers from the readers. Because, of course, everybody understands, Holmes says it too, that the law is the witness and external deposit of our moral life. That is to say, it's not that there is law over here and there is morality over there and there is between them the Rhine. It's that the law is what it does, and what it does may or may not at any given moment be described in moral terms, but it can always be described in the terms of its functions. So that whether a thing is a tax or a fine, well, after all, that was the great subject of the immense quibble over the Affordable Care Act, which consumed both the Supreme Court and the United States Congress in the first part of Donald Trump's only term. Was the requirement to have health insurance a requirement, a tax, a penalty? Did removing the tax penalty requirement change the constitutionality of the statute? From the point of view of any realist onlooker, of whom there were, of course, many million, the question is, what happens if I get sick? And what happens if I don't have the money to pay for the health insurance that the reformed, privatized health insurance system would sell me if I wanted to buy it? All of which has nothing to do with the morality or constitutionality of whether it's a fine or a tax or a requirement, or must I eat the broccoli that the late Nino Scalia seemed to think that it was all about, because of the confusion of words compared to the simplicity of things. When things are what they do, then their relationship to one another lies functionally in what they each do and the ways in which their doing interferes or supports one another, not in logic. The relationship between logic and Holmes, like the relationship between logic and Charles Peirce, is a complicated subject to be pursued philosophically. We shall see next week that this subject of what to do about logic as a technical philosophic matter consumes legal realism all the way from Holmes to, well, critical legal studies. And for the moment, we are idiosyncratically tied to Holmes' particular point about logic, which is, well, let us say, I think, a little deeper than the quibbler will easily get to. Here, the most important element about the way that law traditionally uses logic is to the one in which Holmes is the greatest of leaders and in some ways the most deep of critics, outside the structure of merely asking how much does logic matter to the lawyer in the middle of his work, Holmes, with the dualism which is so deeply part of this piece, both concentrated on the practical matter of the doing and hoping somehow through the realist functional perspective to come to some larger and more abstract understanding, Holmes approaches logic at the beginning in a fashion so fundamental, so deep in the structure of the way things work, that our eye is inclined, I think, to run past it almost defensively. The fallacy, he says, to which I refer is the notion that the only force at work in the development of the law is logic. This is a restrained claim. Law is not the only, logic is not the only force at work in the development of the law. That's not a terribly radical proposition. Even the quibbler will understand how hedged in is that only. Like, if you want to know the law and nothing else, if you want to know only the law, you must look at it from the perspective of the bad man. But immediately having said that, in the broadest sense, indeed, that notion would be true. The postulate on which we think about the universe is that there is a fixed quantitative relation between every phenomenon and its antecedents and consequences. That's a postulate. If there is such a thing as a phenomenon without these fixed quantitative relations, it is a miracle. It is outside the law of cause and effect, and as such transcends our power of thought, or at least is something to or from which we cannot reason. The condition of our thinking about the universe is that it is capable of being thought about rationally, or in other words, that every part of its effect and cause, in the same sense in which these parts are with which we are most familiar. So in the broadest sense, it is true that law is a logical development like everything else. One can read those sentences and come away unscathed only if one doesn't recognize that the point is that logic, far from being an attribute of the universe, is an attribute of our minds. It's the way we have to think about the universe. The condition of our thinking about the universe is that logic is what we have to do it with. We could call that also science, and achieve many of the same insights Holmes is straining for. The way we think about the universe is the human way we think about the universe, and the human mind requires that we think about it logically. Hence, we do. The radicalism of that lies at the level of the abstract, not at the level of the functional and the detailed. One could, in that sense, ignore it, which the reader mostly is inclined to do, but not Holmes. In the end, after all, logic, the most apparently abstract of things, is a human condition, the outcome of our thinking about the world. Well, we can leave the theological requirements of this point of view to another time, though it would be fair to say that he is here as atheistic as I am. I recognize a Lanzmann in him, which I mostly usually don't. But it isn't only that this implies something about who wields logic in the universe. A moment as deep as Einstein's anti-quantum mechanical proposition that God does not play dice with the universe, but also one which ought to remind us that even when we think that law is the creation of logic, it is still only a human thing. And better that we should at least qualify that proposition by recognizing that whatever logic is, whatever frame it is that humans put around the world around them, it is merely one such frame and not the driving force in the law. Functionally speaking, then, logic, when we find it in a judicial opinion or a statute or in a law school classroom or, for that matter, on an exam, is merely one human frame around whatever it is that in society we are proposing to change or prevent from changing using words. The danger, then, of which I speak, he says, is not the admission that the principles governing other phenomena also govern the law, but the notion that a given system, ours, for instance, can be worked out like mathematics from some general axioms of conduct. In that sense, then, he wishes to point out, it cannot be the case that when two judges have two different views of a case, one of them holding more votes and the other fewer, that the dissent is to be blamed for not having done its sums right. An argument in that sense on a collegial court, like, let us say, the United States Supreme Court, between a majority and a dissent is not, and this is true, I think we can all agree, those of us who have had anything to do with putting them together, the argument between a majority and a dissent is not an argument about logic, although logic may come to be wielded in the discussion like any one of a number of other tools. This is what Holmes meant in the first page of his great work, The Common Law, a work of legal history, published in 1881, made him a law professor, if things make law professors other than the egoism of the parties, made him a thinker of the law, and set him on his road to all the various forms of subsequent greatness he achieved. On the first page of The Common Law, he famously said, "The life of the law has not been logic. It has been experience, the felt necessities of the time, the social impulses behind legislation. Even the individual prejudices of the judges have had more to do with what the law was than the logic." This will ultimately convince legal realists to be respectful of fact. And what we mean by fact and what we mean by respectful is much of the work of our next couple of weeks as we try to assemble what we need to be creative lawyering persons. Persons creatively using words to make changes in society. We need a lawyer's theory of social action. A theory about how things happen in society and how to affect them. We need a theory of how people do the deciding of cases, the discussion of how cases ought to be decided, which is a different thing, the deciding how to limit the decisions of future cases by making statutes and regulations and changing the rules by which particular subsequent social actions will be judged, that is to say, where the public force will and will not be used to alter outcomes arrived at previously. In all that stuff that was summarized in the first paragraph or section of the decision, or which led to the observations in the committee reports that made the statute. Everywhere we are asking, how did this social event or series of events or temperaments or backgrounds to events occur, and how could we have changed it? That's a lawyer's theory of social action. And from the from the intellectual point of view, from the ideas to have, if not necessarily the ideas to write down on the exam that doesn't exist. It is the lawyer's theory of creative social action we are building in this course. And Holmes is, for the moment, expressing how, if we avoid confusions of language and don't depend ultimately on logic only to understand how legal ideas are formed in society, if we recognize the felt necessities of the time, the social and political goals and predispositions of the legislators, the prejudices of the judges, and all the other pieces that go into the complex, chaotic structure of social organization and behavior, then perhaps we can begin to have a theory about it. Which is, of course, what he then fills out in the middle of this essay with an extraordinary set of examples of the forms of legal thinking, the kinds of ideas one can create from that perspective. And it is only fair to say that in these few passages in 1897, Holmes anticipates a series of the important legal ideas of the 20th century and even some left over for the 21st. What Guido Calabresi seems to believe that he invented in the cost of accidents is merely the first of Holmes' speculations on this basis. Why don't we think more deeply about the possibility of enterprise liability? That, after all, accidents occur throughout society, and the question is, how do we collectively distribute the cost of accidents, and why we don't therefore consider making actors the insurers for those with whom they deal, if they are best positioned to bear the distribution of the costs. It leads to workers' compensation directly, anticipating the fights of the next decade and a half, or if you take it to its extreme, to the cases in the Supreme Court before the switching time, Save Nine and the New Deal. But it goes beyond that to the problem of how to deal with the accidents that are the inevitabilities of bodily vulnerability and decay, which are the subject of the question how broadly we should bear the costs of one another's illnesses, which still agitates our politics in this society now. The semiotic theory of contracts, that contracts are never built upon a meeting of the mind, but only an agreement of expressions. If you all are using, as I hope you are, the lovely little book of Marvin Chirilstein's on contracts, a demonstration of what it was that made my lost friend Marvin the greatest of all explainers in law school, the best explainer I have ever seen in a law school. If you are using Chirilstein's little book of contracts, then right there on the front, in the picture, is the outcome of Holmes' point here about the semiotic theory of contract. Of course, that picture isn't of either of the two ships, Peerless. As it happens, it's a picture of a third ship, Peerless, which makes it a particularly good place from which to think about the fundamental reality of contract. Or, in his concluding example, trying to understand the theory of not just adverse possession, but a theory of legal prescription altogether, a ratchet in the relationship between people's expectations of their rights, privileges, and liberties, and what the law must ultimately concede them. There isn't, I think, anywhere a better understanding of how that works. Then the proposition that prescription lies as logic lies in the nature of a human mind, a thing which you have enjoyed and used as your own for a long time, whether property or an opinion, takes root in your being and cannot be torn away without your resenting the act and trying to defend yourself, no matter however you came by it. The law can ask no better justification than the deepest instincts of man. Quite a while after I first read that sentence, which was quite a while after Holmes wrote it, Professor Carlin and I put it in a brief to the United States Supreme Court in a case called Planned Parenthood of Southeast Pennsylvania against Casey. It was a central part of the argument that Professor Carlin and I used in explaining why it was that from a constitutional point of view, Roe against Wade is not reversible. Not merely as a matter of stare decisis in the minds of the judges, but as a matter of the fundamental justice owed to all the women of the United States in the past 50 years. Who have grown up having, ultimately, the right to determine for themselves whether to bear a child. Of course, this right, like so many other rights, but in this case explicitly, is limited in its action to those who have the ability to pay to exercise it. And in the end, we have to ask about Harrison McRae, the Hyde Amendment, the effort to prevent the public budgetary power of the wealthiest society on earth to expend itself in the vindication of the most fundamental of women's rights. But when it comes to the question of whether formally that right can be abolished by 5 votes on the United States Supreme Court, Holmes is correct that the law can have no better justification than the deepest instincts of women. And that which they have always had and exercised, whether as an opinion or as a right, depending upon their resources only in the savage inequality of American society, but whether it was an opinion or a right, they have had it, and you cannot take it from them without their struggling to express their resentment over it. And if you look at that portion of the plurality opinion in Planned Parenthood against Casey, written by Justice David Souter, the portion of the plurality opinion which concerns itself with the stare decisis reasoning for not overruling Roe against Wade, one finds there an argument that I would shrink from saying was taken from the brief that Professor Carlin and I wrote. I would say it was taken directly from the understanding that Holmes expressed a century before. The consequence of a concern with what things do rather than with what they are called is to eliminate the idea that the law is an autonomous entity unto itself, and that when we study to create ideas in it, we are studying how to manipulate only the material of the law itself. Interdisciplinarity of understanding is forced upon us if we are inclined to figure out what law is on the basis that things are what they do. Then we have to study what is done. A theory of social action, in other words, has to be based upon a theory of social study. That is to say, it must embrace the ways of knowing what goes on. And those ways are multiple and plural, overlapping, and as we shall see from next week, consilient. That is to say, we believe that which we find from multiple independent ways of reasoning are useful to us, and we create by aggregation. The more carefully we read, as with the more careful mode of our listening to music, the more we understand that there are words and notes and time and harmony of superposition. And in order to understand that which reaches us through our ears like music, we understand by imagination, whereas being primates who grew up in the daytime of the last 5 million years or so, we believe what we see on the basis of its apparent reality without need for imagination. I saw it with my own eyes. But we don't say about music that we heard it with our own ears. We imagined it. We constructed it. We participated in it. And our right brain did what our left brain doesn't do. For Holmes, what this means is that history, economics, and statistics are modes of social cognition. We learn about society in these ways. But to overbalance towards history, like overbalancing towards logic, deprives us of the ability to break habit. Historically, we can understand, as intellectual history, how rules arrive in sequence and in harmony with rules. This was the insight which set me as an undergraduate off towards what I understood to be my future as an intellectual historian of law. I began to try to write about the history of legal ideas, God help me, when I was in high school, when I didn't know how at all. And I spent the years of my early adulthood, roughly, well, if you'll forgive me for saying it, where you are now, thinking that I was becoming an intellectual historian of law, getting a PhD in history, in which the ancillary discipline was law. I had read in college Merritt Roe Smith's wonderful history of the Harper's Ferry Armory, and I thought, yeah, you want to write the history of gun making, the first thing you need to do is learn how guns are made. And if I'm to write the history of legal ideas, then first I have to understand how to read what lawyers write, and thus I went to law school thinking that I was engaged in an ancillary activity, which, if it had been only 3 years long, it probably would have remained, because I didn't like law school all that very much, at least at the beginning, first 3 years or so. But it took me 5. And therefore, in the end, it turned out that it had caught me and that I had learned to love the law and that I was, in fact, also a lawyer, not merely a historian. And from there, various other things could begin to happen. But the problem of the limitation of history as a mode of understanding law, which will not be apparent to a legal historian, but only to a lawyer, is the problem that Holmes presents. The history can tell us what the world has been and can give us, as Holmes is always hoping, that forms of organized knowledge can give us insight into realities that transcend only the human ability to perceive and reason about them. But what it cannot do is tell us what the law should be tomorrow. This, after all, is the point made by my dear friend and co-author Karl Marx in bursting out that the philosophers have made it possible to know what the world is, but the point is to change it. And in order for that to be the case, we must be manipulating not only our history, not only our economics, by which Holmes, of course, means the material consequences, what law does in the sense of changing the scoreboard, who has what and can do what with it, not merely the descriptive power that the statistics or the big data or the whatever it is that we do to understand the realities that go from the pointillist point of knowing what's in everybody's wallet to the political economy of knowing how the overarching patterns in what's in everybody's wallet affects the world. We have to go beyond the processes of knowing in a descriptive sense to the processes of knowing, one might say, in a prescriptive sense, what ought to be, but perhaps more usefully, not just what ought to be, but what we intend. A vision of where we're going, a set of objectives that produce the possibility of strategy, and strategy produces the possibility of success. But that requires, as Holmes points out, imagination, the want of which is not restricted, as he says, to gentlemen's personal gentlemen, but which affects, well, the doers of the world very strongly. And in the sense in which Holmes means it, law school is an imagination test. Almost everybody fails. The most popular mode of failure is not showing up for the exam. This is why the other exams are so fundamentally misguided. Why the evaluation of learning based upon the idea that it constitutes a qualitative or even worse, a quantitative survey of what has been learned, that's all very well if the point is training. Put on your mask before helping others. Leave your shoes on the airplane if you're going to go down an inflatable slide. Always signal lane changes. All right, then it's very good. The evaluation of learning is, did you signal lane changes and did you put on your mask before helping others and did you leave your shoes behind when you went down the inflatable ramp? But training is not the kind of learning we are talking about here. I am content that there is training in law school. Sometimes I do it, but mostly that is not what you and I are here for. Training is the opposite of what we mean here by learning, which is to become something new. The new thing you are becoming is a lawyer with a practice. You weren't that before. You may have been an excellent economist, a thorough statistician, a well-trained historian, an excellent sociologist, an anthropologist of broad and meaningful understanding. We shall see how all of those things would be damn useful. But what you are becoming is a lawyer with a practice. And for that, it is your imagination of yourself which needs to grow. And for that, education is about drawing from you what you can use within yourself to become more of what you want. And that means, oh yes, money. For while we may not all be Descartes or Kant, we all want happiness. and happiness is not, what is the $50,000 of 1897? Not half a million only, maybe 2 million, maybe 5 million of the current dollar. Happiness is not $5 million a year. Well, this is true. Indeed. I have known many unhappy people with very large incomes and quite substantial wealth. El Caudillo de Mar-a-Lago may be very rich or not very rich. That's one of the things which Donald Trump has always lied about. And there are many different opinions about his wealth and his value. But no one who has ever known him, in which unlucky cadre I am, no one who has ever known him has suspected Donald Trump of being happy. Ah, that, of course, you may say is a pathological case, and be completely right. But Holmes' point is so simple as to be inarguable. And truly, money is a psychoactive substance. But perhaps we haven't yet established what that really means. When we think about money as a psychoactive substance, many people seem to feel over the past week that we would be concluding that there's something wrong with it, or that we should minimize our contact with it. People seemed to feel that I was, by pointing out that money is a psychoactive substance, putting it behind us. But that was not the point at all. Coffee is a psychoactive substance. Very valuable and important is caffeine. I have 2 cups a day under current circumstances. And I prefer not to have to do without one. And the other, first thing in the morning, is as indispensable to me as it is to many other people. But I would not, under any circumstances I can imagine, have 6. For after all, the point of psychoactive substances, whether they are the cocaine I used once or the coffee I used twice a day, the point of psychoactive substances in our lives is to know how much is enough. That's why the dose response curve is so important. Is it going to be the case that each next hit will produce less benefit? If so, we must be clear about where we will be willing to sit on that dose response curve. Hence my view about cocaine, that it was wonderful and therefore could be used only once, because it would never get better and it could be very, very much worse. And randomly, at some time or another, it could stop me breathing. Which is not generally the problem of money. Though with lawyers, you must ask yourself such a question. It is true that lawyers have preferential ability to choose their wealth and income. In society, we do not mostly afford people that choice. How rich to be, how much to earn, how much power to have. With a lawyer's license, you can make a practice which will allow you to choose those levels in a way that almost no other people in society are free to do. The crucial question is, how much is enough? The problem isn't finding out how to do without money. That's absurd. My practice currently is responsible for the income and the well-being of, 5 souls in the United States and 15 souls in India and all the families those people support. 20 people's welfare and the welfare of all their families. And in current circumstances, as you might expect, the single most important objective of my practice at the moment is to save the jobs. Today is the 318th day I have spent in my apartment, in isolation, seeking to avoid meeting the virus at an appointment in Samara. And in those 318 days, I sleep, usually well enough. But that would be impossible for me if I thought that the people I work with were about to lose their wages, their health insurance in this savage society, that they and their spouse and their children and the parents they support, that they would find themselves adrift in the chaos and the death of the epidemic. I cannot imagine how anybody could conceive of such a thing without feeling grateful for the ability to create the money which prevents that hardship. Money is a psychoactive substance, and the availability of enough of it to take care of the people who depend on my practice for their well-being is what creates the ability to sleep at night up here for me. So I will yield to nobody in my respect for the importance of money. What is crucial isn't knowing that money is important. What is crucial is knowing how much money is enough. And you can do that, as I can do that. We shall talk soon about how to understand the nut, the costs of your practice, month to month, and how to reason from the nut and the book, that is, the income your practice could produce, to an understanding of how to plan a practice, a subject about which there is a course which I teach, which is about how to plan your practice, about dealing with all these things as though they were realities, as though there were numbers and facts and research that you can do in order to understand how to get what you need in order to be who you want to be. But you have to know what you need. So you have to be able to calculate what is enough so that the material objectives of your practice are defined, not undefined. It doesn't matter what the number is you need. It doesn't matter how much is enough. Tell me $1 million a year. Tell me 200,000. Tell me 100,000. It doesn't matter. You have to know how much is enough. Then it becomes possible to plan. Planning is what makes your practice yours rather than someone else's. Surrendering that the practice is yours, pawning the license for an income, may be an acceptable result if you need to do it in order to have the income. But one of the underlying problems with the default analysis around here is that it assumes that the money available from a salary paid by a large law firm is bigger than other money, and it isn't. It might be enough if what you need is only enough that it fits inside the after-tax number of a large law firm's salary, but it might not be. And to pawn the license might not be the best way of getting that much income, let alone of reaching the ability to create enough. We do need to talk about money all the time, but we need to talk about money on the basis of our understanding that we have defined our needs. There is no strategy without objectives, and there is no strategy without a comprehensive understanding of resources, because the discipline we call strategy is the discipline of matching resources to objectives so as to achieve as many of the objectives as possible given the resources available. Therefore, there is no strategy without an understanding of enough. And the failure to understand enough is a failure of imagination. Not because one can't imagine wealth beyond counting, but because one cannot imagine the cost of wealth beyond counting. Hence, Goethe and his Faust. If we are to understand realistically what it means to have our practice, then we must realistically plan a practice which always produces enough money. It must never produce less than enough. It has to be designed to produce enough, And in order to do that, there has to be enough, a number, enough. This is enough. This will achieve my objectives. That work is not hard, but it's hard to do if you don't know that you need to. And of course, if you don't know what you are doing, somebody else who knows what she is doing will take advantage of you. Let us call her Sullivan and Cromwell, or Cravat, Swain and Moore, or, well, let us call her Big Law and be done with it. And therefore, the question is, when we commit to our practice, what are we committing to? Not to words, not only to ideas, but to measurable realities. What we want, what we need, what we hope for, and how to put them together in order to have a life that we actually love to live. So here, then, is the time for us to begin turning the braid to ask what is as fundamentally the realism of practice as Holmes offers us in the realism of the ideas about law that we use. our practice exists now. You have one, and I have one. Each of us has a practice. That is to say, we are people living in the world trying to be lawyers in it. My practice is different from yours because I have a license now, and you don't have a license now. In a technical sense, in the bad man sense, if you solicit clients, if you hold yourself out as a lawyer and ask people to pay you money in order to do things for them, somebody might punish you. Because the law requires you to have a law license before you can do that. But that doesn't mean you don't have a practice. In your third year of law school, you can do that as long as you are working with a lawyer with a license. Right now, you can't do it at all, but that doesn't prevent you from getting results for people or even for receiving pay. You simply must not be providing legal services and soliciting clients without the previous and supervising employment of a lawyer. But a lawyer could pay you to help her do anything that she can do with her license, even now. So you have a practice. Of course, in addition to being unlicensed, your practice is probably dormant. You haven't done any lawyering. You are making nothing happen in society using words. But you could. I had no license yet. While I was clerking, I took the bar exam after I left the Supreme Court. Yet, of course, I had been making things happen in society using words for 2 years. The person who signed those words was a judge with an Article III commission. Whether it was Edward Weinfeld or it was Thurgood Marshall, I was only writing for him, but the words were doing things in society. And they were, at least much of the time, at least I hope, things I wanted to have done. So you have a practice. The license is one of the two fundamental moving parts of your practice. Every practice, every law practice in the United States and the world now has two moving parts conceptually. If you want to draw the blueprint of the practice, there are basically two moving parts in it, and the details follow underneath. So what are the two moving parts of a law practice? One, there is your knowledge, the things you know how to do, the results you can get for the client. Let us call those the license. Let us say that the license is not merely the right legally to do some things without falling afoul of the regulator. The license is a metaphorical holder, a cup containing the stuff you know how to do. Law school puts stuff in your license. Stuff regulatorily, you had the required number of hours of instruction face-to-face or synchronously or maybe on Zoom. But the license also is the intellectual content that you gained over the course of years of study here, and from my point of view, even more, the ability to learn more things, the way to put results in your license, your ability to know how to deliver results and to learn how to deliver other results for clients. That's the first moving part, and notice that that moving part is in your head. We make our livings on our wits, in that sense, in our practice. The second component of the practice, the second moving part in the machine, which is the practice you already have and want to make better, the second component of your practice is the network. The network is the collection of people who help you to deliver those results and who help you identify and recruit the clients who will pay you to deliver those results. That's the network. The network is actually as crucial to the practice as everything in the license put together. Because although you do make your living by your wits, you cannot make your living by your wits only. Making things happen in society using words happens in society. And the network is your social constructions for making the words effective, for getting the results and for getting the clients who pay for the results to be delivered. Let us suppose that every law school, then, is both a place working on your license and working with you on the creation of your network. Now we can begin to understand why a law school might be worth a lot of money. You can, as you now know, get everything put into your license that Columbia Law School can put there far less expensively in other law schools. And while it might be conventional to declare that here are the better teachers with the more genius in them, fundamentally, of course, what goes into your license, the knowledge of how to produce results, is not dependent upon the quality of their genius. I have lived with these geniuses for a third of a century, and I will tell you that for sure. The basis upon which a law school like Columbia is worth what you pay for it lies on the other side of the development of your practice. A law school like this one, or the people we refer to all the time compulsively as our peer schools, law schools like us and our peer schools have a network so much wider, deeper, higher, more comprehensive, more thoughtfully assembled than any single law practice or government agency in the society. Our network's vastness means that under ordinary circumstances, which these are not, when you attend this law school, you have the opportunity to cut and graft from the immensity of this network to frame your own. And it is the superior availability of network that is the real increase in value for which the law school deserves, or at least can command, its price. Now, this is also an explanation of what is wrong with law school under epidemic conditions. The network construction function of law school is not quite completely dead, but even more impaired than the intellectual function of law school under the conditions of Zoom school. Yes, the intellectual ability to deliver in Zoom school is lousy, which is why I'm not putting you in Zoom school. We can do more for you without the video conference delusion than we can with it. But even so, I would not want to say that we can do better now than we could do with a functioning theater in the process of helping educate you. But that's not very important. I mean, it's not good, but it's not terrible. The network development function of law school is almost entirely kaput. And it will remain so until we have a building which is open and which has strangers in it. That's when, from my point of view, it would be economically appropriate to return to law school. When we have a building which is open and there are strangers in it, because it is the Grand Central Station of the American legal order that is Columbia Law School, on Manhattan Island, one cab ride away from everywhere, which makes its network so available to you. Not that the alumni are gone, not that everybody doesn't care anymore, now not that the administration isn't going to be constantly thinking about things being thought about by Columbia law professors, and there won't be Zoom occasions. Of course there will, and webinars and bullshit up the wazoo. But you need the strangers to be passing through. You need to be able to meet the people. You want mentoring, you want advice, you want examples, you want understanding, you want chit-chat, you want kibitzing. Great. We need the strangers in the building. We need everybody passing through. We need a ton of things happening every day at which you can drop in and meet the person who's going to be useful to you in this or that or some other way. The people who are going to change your life. The network that builds your practice. That's what you must have. That's what we are at the moment unable to deliver. But that's just the epidemic, and notwithstanding all the mismanagement and harmful indifference to the loss of human life, one day we will blunder through the end of this, and at that point, that tuition which you pay for networking will no longer be completely wasted money. Your practice will always require license, results you know how to get, and network the people who help you do it and who help you find the clients that you need to deliver the results for which you get paid. Of course, another way to do it is to live inside the walled garden of a law firm's network. It finds the clients, it defines the results, it tells you what you're to do, it makes you part of a machine for delivering that result, all very easy. And, of course, to say of it that one went there for the training would be accurate only in the sense that you have heard the speech about put on your mask before helping others, leave your shoes behind when you jump onto the, etc. But that's not training that you needed, that's the education that you needed, which the firm did not provide. It may have taught you how to get certain results. It helped you with the license it was keeping in pawn for you. And it had network, but it deeply, deeply, deeply does not want you cutting pieces off that network and carrying them away in order to graft them onto the stock of your own practice. And this is why what we must do realistically is to learn here, that is, to develop in you here the commitment to the care of your own license and the health of your own network, the relationships that are how you become the most of yourself. Naturally, we want to know that our practice will be committed back, that it will feed us, not just materially, not just intellectually, morally, politically, socially, that we will thrive in it as we wish to thrive in the most important of our human relationships. That's what's really at stake here. As you cope with the prediction of the anomie of a practice in which you might not be at all happy, but on the other hand, it would feed your family and take care of them. When I came to Columbia Law School in 1987, the last offer made by Cravath to me was $83,000 a year more than Columbia Law School would pay me to teach. And the last argument on my mind for going there, which is an argument that I have heard made here in the last week by some of you, is that if I went there, I would know that for three generations, nobody in my family would ever want for money again. And I thought that was a really important argument, as you do, and it is. My family didn't think that. My parents and my brothers were deeply unhappy at the thought of my going to Cravath. In the social and political and intellectual life of my family, they thought that would be a waste. And maybe their absence of concern for whether I was going to take care of them and their offspring for generations made it easier for me to say no and to come here instead. But I don't think it really mattered. I think in the end, what made my mind up was the understanding that, after all, this was my life. And that the people who loved me and the people I would love who would come into existence from the people I loved would not be better off for my unhappiness, unsatisfaction, unfulfillment, limitation. But that even if they would, in the end, it was my life to lead. And just as I first went out to work at 14 years of age without asking anybody, I just came home and told my parents I had a job programming computers. They were just gobsmacked. They gave me everything I needed. Why did I need a job? But of course, I think they knew why I needed a job. Just as I know why you need a job. Just as I know why it is therefore terribly, terribly sad if it turns out that your need for a job doesn't mean your need for the practice that would make you happy and fulfilled, materially comfortable and socially empowered. But that's what we are all here, not here. Together, apart, for. Talk to you soon.